For the next hour, we'll be taking a look at what goes into the making of Monocle. We'll be stepping beyond the pages and we'll bring you the voices behind the written word and the lens.
Coming up, we'll be having lunch with John Malkovich.
We'll be exploring the streets of Bogota.
And we'll be teeing off with the rich in South Korea.
All that to come here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, let's get the latest news from around the globe with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The liberation of Libya will be declared on Saturday in the city of Benghazi, often referred to as the cradle of the revolution that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi and not in the capital, Tripoli. Interim government officials said the chairman of the ruling National Transitional Council, Mustafa Abdul Jalil, will make the announcement. The decision has been taken. The declaration of the liberation will be in Benghazi, not Tripoli. A declaration of liberation is supposed to signal a formal move of the interim authorities from Benghazi, the second city in the Far East, to Tripoli, the capital in the West. The choice of either Benghazi or Tripoli as the location for the declaration has been the subject of debate and speculation since Gaddafi was killed yesterday. Some analysts say that long-standing regional rivalries in a country only put together under Italian colonial rule in the 1930s are part of a complex of tribal, ethnic and other divisions that could hamper a return to stability. Libya's new leaders will have to dig deep to find billions of dollars in cash and assets that Muammar Gaddafi and his family stashed around the world, and then will face daunting legal hurdles to recover them all. Syrian forces have shot dead at least 13 anti-government protesters whose numbers were swelled by the killing of Colonel Gaddafi, according to residents and activists. Most of the killings were in the central city of Homs and in Hama to the north, the scene of some of the largest military operations in a crackdown on the seven-month uprising. Spain's defence minister has ruled out any negotiations with the separatist group ETA following its announcement that it's laying down its arms. Yesterday, it said it was halting its 43-year-long bloody campaign for an independent Basque state in territory straddling northern Spain and southwest France. A Lithuanian court has sentenced Irish citizen Michael Campbell to 12 years in jail for seeking to acquire weapons and explosives in Lithuania to arm a Northern Irish Republican militant group after a sting operation 3 years ago. Campbell was arrested in the Balkan state after an operation involving Lithuanian, Irish and British secret services. Thailand battled to protect the capital Bangkok from being swamped by water today, with canals full to the brim after devastating floods across the region that sources in neighbouring Myanmar said had killed at least 100 people there. After trying to hold the line for a week, the Thai government opened some canals to allow water to run through the inner city, carrying the risk of inundating some districts but relieving pressure on dikes. Two little-known Eritrean rebel groups said today they had killed 12 government soldiers in an early morning attack. The Red Sea Afar Democratic Organization and the Eritrean National Salvation Front said they carried out the raid in southern Eritrea. A Russian Soyuz rocket successfully blasted off from French Guiana today, bearing the first two satellites in Europe's Galileo Global Positioning System, a much-heralded mission that will redraw commercial competition in space. And finally, a new global art prize competition for pictures created using a mobile device opens today to any competitor bold enough to subject their work to scrutiny by a jury. The two-stage competition calls for contestants to submit an online stream of original images created and shared on a social network using a mobile device, smartphone or tablet. And those are the latest top stories on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
I think most of us across Europe have felt the autumn chill by now. Coats and gloves and hats have been out. And again on Friday, many major cities woke up to temperatures near or below freezing. Saturday morning will be equally as cold. But the good news is, if you don't like the cold weather, it'll be warming up a little bit over the weekend. Here's the Business Centre's forecast for Saturday and Sunday. London warming up actually to 17 degrees with some pleasant sunshine. Paris, there'll be a few clouds around and blue sky, 17 as well, so warming up here too. Frankfurt, a little bit cooler at 13. but also sunny. And remember, the chilly mornings. And an additional outlook at some of the warmer Mediterranean destinations. Athens at 23 degrees, it'll be sunny here too. Venice cooler at 13, but Barcelona a very pleasant 21 degrees and sunshine. And the weather for air travel is still looking good overall over the entire weekend across most of continental Europe. But just a reminder, if you're catching those early morning flights, be prepared for the possibility of stubborn fog and maybe even a delay. We've recently had some fog at Frankfurt Airport, for example. For the transatlantic flights, however, there's a very strong jet stream still coming out of Canada, peaking at 300 kilometres an hour. Turbulence mid-flight is certainly on the cards. The jet stream will be much weaker later on next week, slowing down to only 100 kilometres an hour, which is actually not too fast for a jet stream. Make the most of the good weather this weekend across Europe while it lasts. The jet stream next week will blow in cloud and rain and gusty conditions into Western Europe. Let's have a look at Canada and the US now. And after a stormy week, it's looking much quieter on Friday and into the weekend. Rather than the nasty low pressure and wind that we had across the eastern states, we now have a sunny high pressure across most of the eastern seaboard and indeed the rest of the United States. The weather conditions at most major airports across the US should be good this Friday and during the weekend too. In Canada, however, British Columbia is in for a soaking, so the weather in Vancouver is not looking very good on Friday, and indeed not on Saturday. Here's a city forecast for Friday and into the weekend. New York City will be bright most of the time, around 17 degrees. DC, sunny at 18. In San Francisco, the city by the bay, will be very warm indeed. A high of 28 degrees and some hot sun, well above average for the time of year. Vancouver, however, a wet start to the weekend, but the sun is back on Sunday and 13 degrees. And finally, a quick look at Japan. The last few days have been very nice in Japan, but now a big change on the way for Saturday. It's looking cloudy with spells of rain across most of Kyushu, Honshu and Hokkaido. That's the weather. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here at Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and Santiago Tarditi. In a moment, we'll be having lunch with a film icon. But first, Santiago, let's have a quick look at the interesting stories that are setting the agenda in Asia and in Australasia. They'll be waking up to it by this time. We're 6 minutes past six in London at Midori House. Santiago, what catches your eye?
Well, Libya is obviously top of the headlines, and the Straits Times in Singapore titles that Australian Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd said the West must work closely with Libya's new government to ensure it avoided Iran's path after the fall of the Shah.
The other papers are beginning to move away from the Libya story. We go to South Korea in the Chosun Ilbo. There's an enormous enormous discovery by the Korean Gas Corporation. It's found a large natural gas deposit off the coast of Mozambique. And the Ministry of Knowledge Economy says that if they've got their numbers right, this new deposit will secure Kenya about 34 million tonnes of natural gas, which apparently is about a year's worth of the country's consumption.
The Occupy wave keeps going around the world, and in Melbourne, the police chief defended the use of force against the Occupy Melbourne protesters as they used the heavy-handed tactics to break up the protests yesterday, where the riot and mounted police and the dog squad included were used to disperse a few hundred protesters, says the Australian's front page.
Staying down in the near Australia, we've got New Zealand. Staying with New Zealand, we have more developments on the Rena oil spill disaster that obviously has been making the headlines for the last few days. But it's proving to be quite a profitable business. Although people were really worried at the beginning that tourists would stay away because of the effect on the area around Mount Maunganui, what in actual fact is that all the television crews and the salvage groups are filling the restaurants and are making business booming instead of all the chaos that was predicted. That is a story that you can see in the New Zealand Herald. But Santiago, I think we need to introduce you. You are, according to your job title, the acting edits editor. Now, for the last couple of days, we've had the design editor in and we've had the culture editor, and that's, I'd imagine, a fairly self-explanatory job. But an edits editor, tell us, what is that?
Well, edits is the funnest of all the sections.
Oh, absolutely, I agree all the way.
I know my colleagues are going to kill me, but it is the funnest because it's the travel and consumer-related section of the magazine. So we go around the world highlighting new openings, new hotels, restaurants, boutiques.
So you do this job obviously for us because it sounds so tough.
It is tough, actually. Well, I can't obviously go all over the world to do this, so we rely heavily upon our network of correspondents. But I try to do one or two things for every magazine.
So if we're briefly looking at this month's Monocle magazine, where are we going in the edits section?
In the edit section, well, we're going to Berlin to find some very nice crockery. Then we're having lunch with a famous star. Can I say who it is?
No, apparently we can't. Not yet.
South of France. Very nice restaurant in south of France.
Lovely.
And we're also having some recipes for Danish food.
Do you know, I think we actually did give away the name of the film star right at the beginning of the programme. So the more discerning listener will have picked up the intended error there. We'll keep those who weren't paying quite so much attention hanging until we actually get to the item itself. But for the moment, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be right back in a moment.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's lovely. Thank you.
Gabriel, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm not buying you.
La Candelaria, a neighbourhood in central Bogotá, has always been famous for its architecture, Spanish colonial and Baroque. But now it's attracting a new generation of artists, creatives and young people who are all looking for a cosy neighbourhood away from the chaos of the rest of the city. So much so, it's now been called Colombia's microcosm of urban regeneration. La Candelaria is now the subject of a new film that's just appeared on our Monocle website. In a moment, we'll be talking to Gabriel Lee, who made the film, but first, let's hear a little bit of it.
The Candelaria is the historic centre of Bogotá, the city's oldest neighbourhood set directly in the middle of miles of modern sprawl. Unusually for Bogotá, it's home to both rich and poor. Its hilly streets are the setting for some of the city's finest houses, and also home to families who've been living here modestly for generations. It's also a big draw for tourists, despite being known for its roaming muggers as much as its colorful colonial-era buildings. And it's a place where many foreigners have settled, buying cheap property in an area they see as distinctive and full of character. The Colombians who've moved here feel the same. Many find it appealing because it allows for a different type of living than the rest of the city. Just like the ever-changing houses of Franco and Vélez, the Candelaria is in transition. Universities and museums are buying up old buildings, and families who've lived here for generations generally prefer to take the money and go elsewhere. It means the buildings get restored and looked after, but it also means a changing population, as more of the old Candelaria families leave. But the people who move here bring injections of creativity and enterprise, and often an alternative perspective. The Candelaria is like a rough around the edges microcosm of urban regeneration. Guillermo Londoño, also a Candelaria resident, saw that artists here had a desperate need for space, so he suggested that an old high-rise building that had sat vacant for years be turned into studios. Now the place is packed with some of Colombia's brightest young talents.
Now it's becoming a good business. You can have an old building and amazingly, artists, we pay rent. It's the first of its kind, and it has enriched people to produce buildings like this one for other artists. What I love the La Candelaria, when I first rented my first apartment, was that it was a little country on itself. It was a little Colombia on itself. And that made it absolutely wonderful and beautiful.
The Candelaria might now be at a point when it has found the perfect balance. It's safer, but still has an edge. It's livable, but not overrun. And the population is still a balanced one, with representatives from various social classes and age groups, and a steady injection of new people coming in, bringing money and ideas. As with many such neighborhoods, the balance is a delicate one, but the course it's taken over the past years has so far seen its character and its buildings mostly preserved.
Well, it's a little bit more empty on its soul, on its sort of intimacy. But on the other hand, it has improved its security, and houses have been restored very well. That happened in London, it has happened in New York, and it's going to happen here at one point or another. It is what it has to be. There's no way of avoiding it. It's been saved for the good of Bogota, which at one point I thought it would never happen.
In Bogota for Monocle, I'm Gabriel Lee.
Well, the man who made the film is Gabriel Lee, Monocle's video journalist. Gabriel, what attracted you to going to La Candelaria in the first place?
Well, the Candelaria, I think, you know, as I mentioned in the film, it's a place that's sort of unlike the rest of Bogota, which is this massive city and really characterized by sort of neighborhoods that are all of a certain type of kind of population, of certain type of thing. Like you have the north of Bogota is very, you know, where the wealthier people are. The south is the poorer side. And in the right in the center, there's the Candelaria, which is sort of where everything comes together, it seemed like to me. It's sort of a mixture of both wealthy and poor, as well as, you know, people from Bogota, people from other parts of Colombia, and a lot of foreigners as well. So combining that with the kind of very old, beautiful architecture, colorful buildings, hilly streets, that seemed like a kind of, it's a very different part of Bogota, a very small part of it, and where a lot happens.
It does look very, very different from any other area of Bogota that you might see, because when you look at your film, which is very beautifully filmed and very beautifully shot, you're really struck by the fact that there are lots of little buildings all painted in different beautiful, beautiful colours. But the overall impression you get of the place is that it's really quiet. You don't get any signs of enormous buses or cars going around. Your film showed an almost like village-like place.
Yeah, that's right. It's much different from the rest of Bogota in that sense as well. I mean, the rest of Bogota is very hectic, chaotic, or at least it can be, along the big avenues. And there it does feel like something of a village. Yeah, it's very quiet.
In your film, you talk about foreign residents who've moved in. What kind of people are moving into this place now?
You have a whole mix, you know, people from Europe, Americans, people from other parts of South America. And then from what I've been told and from the people I met while I was there, a lot of French people moving into Candelaria for some reason. One French, I think it's a French couple, started a quite renowned bakery there.
So the smell of croissant is permeating the air of Bogota at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make it too far, but yeah.
Santiago, I mean, you have a real secret to disclose. Your father actually had a house in this area, doesn't he? What's it like there?
Yeah, the house is actually not too far from the French bakery, which is delicious, I have to say. It's a very calm part of the town. It has beautiful houses, it has museums, some of the government's buildings are there. It's a safe haven away from all the bustling streets of the rest of the city. Gabriel, I wanted to ask you, who or what captured your attention in La Candelaria?
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned sort of the beautiful houses, and the first time that I was in Colombia living there 3 years ago, I saw that there were beautiful buildings and many had been renovated, but I never really went inside to any of these incredible houses. I didn't even know they were there. And the people that you actually put me in touch with, like Pedro Franco, and then he put me in touch with the architect Simon Vélez, both of them appear in the film. They've made these incredible houses over time. They've been there for decades, sort of building onto these houses, especially Simon Vélez. They were just incredible to see. I mean, they're really hidden behind these walls. And you go in and all of a sudden this kind of world of wonders is opened up to you.
You see the world of wonders, but something else on your film is that they're regenerating the sort of the eyesores of Bogota as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, one thing that appears in the film is one of these old high-rise buildings that really was standing vacant for many years. It doesn't look like much from the outside.
It's a very ugly building, I have to say. I've seen it before.
So this building, right, like we said, it's just terribly ugly. And what Simon Vélez, this architect who works a lot with bamboo, he's been contracted by an unnamed, very wealthy man who wanted to put a bamboo house.
Sorry, Gabriel, I have to correct you because it's actually guadua, which is a type of bamboo only found in Colombia. It's more flexible,
oh, right, okay.
I mean, it's the same. It does look like a bamboo.
I think that's you've been told, Gabriel.
Yeah, I guess. In any case, this native type of Colombian bamboo has been used to make basically an apartment on the penthouse, basically, of this building. They knocked out the top floor, and it looks nothing like the rest of this ugly brick building. And it's got these incredible views out over all of Bogota, and it's still being built, but it's going to be this sort of incredible structure. And you can kind of see it from a distance. It looks like some kind of spaceship that set down on top of this building. It's pretty incredible.
Now, Santiago and also Gabriel, I'll ask you about this individually. You do have to mention the safety issue. I mean, Santiago, you were saying that you go there, but your friends don't. Is that right? Tell us about that.
I like the neighborhood because it's like going to East London. It's where the trendy bars are and the best inexpensive restaurants are. So I try to make the most of it. But my friends are always reluctant to go. They feel unsafe for some reason. I've never had any problems there. And actually, one of the people Gabriel interviewed, Guillermo Londoño, I asked, because he has a beautiful house there and he's been living there for a while, I asked him if it was a dangerous spot. And he's actually friends with the people
who have a bad reputation, and what they told him is that every time they want to go and rob someone, they do it away from La Candelaria, because La Candelaria is like a very tranquil spot. It's not a spot where wealthy people come, so nothing really happens inside that neighborhood. It's a more touristy area too, so.
Is it? I mean, what proportion of the people there are tourists? I mean, is it quite a big destination?
If I'm showing Bogota to one of my friends, I take them to my foreign friends. I take them to La Candelaria and to La Plaza Bolívar and all the nice houses and museums there, because it's the cultural hotspot of the city.
It's also the new business hotspot. I mean, Gabriel, you mentioned in your film the amazing little hairdressers where you go in and the woman says, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do to you. I'm going to create a work of art and you can't see a mirror. I mean, frankly, that would terrify me. But this is just an example of a resurgence or a new wave of businesses that's moving into La Candelaria, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems to be happening particularly with people that are sort of, you know, artists or working in some field of art. In this case, the peluqueria, where they cut your hair without mirrors, you know, they sort of claim that what they do is kind of a work of art, that they do art with people's hair, you know, experimenting with it. And part of the game is that people don't really get to choose what happens and they don't get to see as it happens. Well, there was another example of with the girl that Santiago, you know as well, I guess, Juliana Steiner, right?
Yeah, I do.
Who they're renovating an old theater and making it into this. It's a nonprofit art organization, making it into a space for showing art, for putting on performances. And I think actually right now they're putting on a contemporary art fair to sort of rival the traditional art fair in Bogota, which is further out.
Okay, Gabriel, just to finish this interview, I know you're a fan of Colombian arepas. These are delicious corn patties found everywhere in the country. Did you eat some in your latest trip? And are you finally convinced that Colombian arepas are best than the Venezuelan ones?
You know what I'm going to say about that is I don't think you can compare the Colombian and Venezuelan arepas.
Because Colombians are better, right?
I'm not going to go as far as to say that. I'd say that they're totally different. I mean, Colombian arepas are delicious. Venezuelans do it in such a different way. I think if I had to choose one to live with the rest of my life, it would be the Venezuelans. I'm sorry.
Gabriel, can you just explain to me, I'm an arepas idiot, I don't know what one is, so you're going to have to explain one to me and why there is this enormous rivalry between the Colombians and the Venezuelans.
That might be better explained by Santiago, but
we're brothers. We're actually brothers. There isn't a rivalry in a bad sense. We're just brothers who fight over everything.
What is it? What is an arepas?
Arepa is a corn patty. So they're like tortillas, like the Mexican tortillas, only thicker, and some of them have cheese inside. Those are like the most the more traditional ones, with cheese in the middle, and people just have them for breakfast with some butter on top and some salt.
So basically, are you rowing with each other about who makes a better toast for breakfast?
Yeah, kind of. I will say that on the road going north into the mountains out of Bogota, where you stop in a village, Santiago, what's that village called?
La Calera.
It's famous for La Calera, yeah. It's famous for its arepas on the roadside, and they make them in these little fire oven type things. Those are delicious, I'll say.
That sounds amazing. Gabriel, I understand that you're now going to be making more films like this. You're going to be going and doing a regeneration project for Monocle. Obviously, you won't be doing the regeneration yourself, but you'll be taking your camera. Where are you going next?
Well, actually, I've already been, and we've got a film coming up, which is being edited right now, from Istanbul, from a neighborhood in Istanbul called Karakoy, where there's kind of a similar situation, although it's quite different. I mean, it's a sort of old neighborhood filled with a lot of old hardware shops, just hundreds of them, and they're selling their items out of ancient Byzantine buildings, which are their workshops and where they store all their spare tools and things like that. And there's a big redevelopment project that's being talked about for that area to sort of open up the waterfront, bring in tourists. And it's one of these places, you know, that we're looking at in the series that are in some kind of stage of transition from sort of their old selves into something new, and what might happen and what that might do to the neighborhood.
Well, Gabriel, we'll look forward to that one. And in the meantime, can you send me some arepas through the post, please?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Gabriel Lee, our video journalist. And his film is online now, I believe, on monocle.com. Go and have a look at it. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, before we move on to our next item, Santiago, I must confess that at the end of that interview, which we have to admit we recorded earlier on today because of the time difference between where we were and where Gabriel was, after that interview was conducted, you didn't know that we still had the the tape's still rolling. And the listener may have picked up a slight degree of animosity between yourself and Gabriel when it came to this issue of the arepa. I think we should play the good listeners of Midori House what then ensued, which can only be described as a testosterone-filled duel. Have a listen to this.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, it's lovely. Thank you.
Gabriel is still there.
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm not buying you any more arepas when you come here to London, Gabriel. I thought you loved the arepas de yuca.
I do. It's not like I hate the Colombian arepas, you know? I tried to be fair and balanced about that.
Fair? You said the Venezuela ones were better.
Yeah, because that's kind of true.
Kind of true? How?
Well, you know, they pack them full of delicious things like meat and...
No, that's not a traditional arepa. What they do is like a sandwich. They just fill it with everything. It's like,
yeah, but that's
it's like
why
what,
I
mean, it's like, it's like comparing a traditional New Yorker hot dog. A hot dog has to be a bun, a sausage, a bit of mustard, and a bit of ketchup. Not relish and cucumber and shrimp and eggs and a pile of things that don't make any sense. You have to keep it traditional.
Yeah, but I would still be entitled to prefer the shrimp hot dog, right? I mean, you can't stop me from that.
Oh, Santiago, you're taking this really seriously. Why are you so passionate about arepa?
Because I used to eat them every day when I was in Colombia. It's like our breakfast, our traditional thing.
I mean, what surprised me was the absolute degree of passion that you and Gabriel engaged in. I mean, it was almost as if you were going to challenge the other one to step outside for a manly fight.
Well, I did spend a couple of bucks on buying Gabriel's arepas and trying to change his mind.
All right, so the man owes you one, basically.
Yeah, he owes me more than one, actually. They come in packs of six.
Well, before you go out and start beating poor Gabriel up... For the past couple of days here on Midori House on Monocle 24, we've been getting our editors to come in and hand-pick some songs to play us to give a flavour of what their section of the magazine could sound like. We started off really well until yesterday. We got Hugo in, the design editor, and he just played some of his favourite songs. Santiago, what treats have you brought us?
Well, I organize a Latin American playlist, if you don't mind.
That's fine.
And I'd like to start with a street tune by a French-Chilean singer called Ana Tijoux, and this is 1977, an ode to the year she was born in. Such a powerful song. I heard the song for the first time this morning. A friend recommended it, and I love it. What did you think about it, Emma?
I think it was absolutely gorgeous. I couldn't stop. Yeah, and was distracted by, just deeply distracted from my job here by wanting to actually listen to the radio.
There was a bit of dancing in the studio.
A small amount of what could not necessarily be described as dancing, but movement, movement of some sort. It's approaching the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll be examining what drives the South Koreans to the golf course. But in the meantime, at the time at 31 minutes past the hour, here's a summary of the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Emma. The liberation of Libya will be declared on Saturday in the city of Benghazi, often referred to as the cradle of the revolution that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, and not in the capital, Tripoli. A declaration of liberation is supposed to signal a formal move of the interim authorities from Benghazi, the second city in the Far East, to Tripoli, the capital in the West. Libya's new leaders will have to dig deep to find billions of dollars in cash and assets that Muammar Gaddafi and his family stashed around the world, and then will face daunting legal hurdles to recover them all. Syrian forces have shot dead at least 13 anti-government protesters whose numbers were swelled by the killing of Colonel Gaddafi, according to residents and activists. Spain's defence minister has ruled out any negotiations with the separatist group ETA following its announcement that it's laying down its arms. The Lithuanian court has sentenced Irish citizen Michael Campbell to 12 years in jail for seeking to acquire weapons and explosives in Lithuania to arm a Northern Irish Republican militant group after a sting operation 3 years ago. Burma's foreign minister met with the Japanese foreign minister today in another sign that one of the world's most isolated states is beginning to open up. Thailand battled to protect the capital, Bangkok, from being swamped by water today, with canals full to the brim after devastating floods across the region that sources in neighbouring Myanmar said had killed at least 100 people there. Two little-known Eritrean rebel groups said today that they had killed 12 government soldiers in an early morning attack. The Red Sea Afar Democratic Organization and the Eritrean National Salvation Front said they carried out the raid in southern Eritrea. A Russian Soyuz rocket successfully blasted off from French Guiana today, bearing the first two satellites in Europe's Galileo Global Positioning System, a much-heralded mission that will redraw commercial competition in space. A Dutch court sentenced five ethnic Tamil men on Friday to up to 6 years in jail for helping finance Tamil Tiger guerrillas with millions of euros in their ultimately failed campaign for an independent homeland in Sri Lanka. And finally, London's St Paul's Cathedral will close, a senior cleric said today, because of the hazards posed by an Occupy Wall Street-inspired protest encamped in front of the cathedral. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with Santiago Tarditi and Emma Nelson. We'll be back in a moment asking, what does John Malkovich like for lunch? The answer is not half as glamorous as you'd think. Back in an instant.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Every month, the Monocle shop unveils a new collection of collaborations available on monocle.com and in our shops in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Tokyo, and Osaka. This month sees a range of new bags added to our collection from Porter of Japan, a new blazer from London-based designer Oliver Spencer, as well as our regular lineup of stationery, CDs, posters, and books. Pop into our shops or visit us online at shop.monocle.com.
Emma, do you know what reggaeton is?
No, tell me.
Well, I will let the right person to not only tell you what it is, but to sing you a song. This is called El Doctorado. And every time I hear this song from this Puerto Rican artist, I get the urge to get up and dance.
What does El Doctorado mean?
It means the PhD. This guy claims to have a PhD in love.
Brainy guy.
Here you go. El Doctorado by Tony Dize.
Pienso en el momento en que te conocí.
El Doctorado by Tony Dees here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Santiago Tarditi, our edits editor, is joining us and he's choosing the music this afternoon. Santiago, you chose a song which effectively is called Doctor Love, is that right?
Well, it's called The PhD, but he talks a lot about love, so yeah, I guess he's the appropriate person to talk about it. The more devoted Monocle reader will know My Last Meal. You can find it in the E section. It's about a lunch or a dinner with someone Monocle loves, and it explores that person's life and work through their relationship with food.
Now, one of the conditions of this interview is that it must be conducted over a meal. And this month sees our correspondent Sophie Grove lunching in the south of France with none other than John Malkovich. Sophie joins us in the studio, having dragged herself away from Provence to come and talk to us in this chilly studio in Midori House in London. Sophie, welcome to Monocle 24.
Thank you. Hi.
Lovely to have you with us. What a amazing thing to have a lunch with John Malkovich. How did all that come about then?
Well, it was partly to do with his business partner, because he's a bit of a polymath. He's also a fashion designer. He's got a brand called Techno Bohemian, and I think his Italian fashion partner is a big fan of Monocle, so that's how it came about.
And how did you actually make first contact with Mr. Malkovich? Because Midori House, as far as we know, is we go behind the stories that we can read in the magazines. So you are basically told to go to this restaurant in the Luberon. And then what do you do?
Well, we arrived first. I went with a photographer and we arrived first. And John Malkovich arrived in the smallest, nondescript French car on his own, which was quite surprised, because sometimes these Hollywood types kind of come with a huge entourage and, you know, PR people, and they've only have 25 minutes and things. He rocked up on his own and then stayed for the best part of 3 hours. Just really, it was very relaxed and really quite enjoyable, actually. I almost forgot that I was meant to be interviewing him. So we sort of, it was great, because there is a bit of a morbid edge to this page, in the sense that you have to talk about the last meal and kind of death and those things, which can be quite difficult. But he's thought about it a lot because of his roles and just the person he is, really.
Well, Malkovich has done more than 70 movies, and personally, his roles in Empire of the Sun and the eponymous film being John Malkovich are my favorite. Does he act in real life like he does in the movies?
Yes, I think. I mean, he's got these piercing eyes, brown eyes, and he's very intense. I mean, you can just see, he reminded me of Victor de Valmont in Dangerous Liaisons quite a lot, in the sense that he was just very charming, but slightly kind of dark at the same time. Very sort of engaging and fascinating company, but with a little bit of the sort of, he loved talking about his last meal, and he loved talking about the idea of his last day on the earth and things like that.
What did he say about his last day?
Well, he just said that he wants everyone to be, you know, extremely happy, and that he doesn't have a huge ego, or so he says. He says he likes to think of himself as completely sort of insignificant, and that the world will.
It seems he has a huge appetite, though. He said he ate 600 Oreos once.
I think that was for a film. But it sounds like he's from the Midwest. His parents are journalists. And I think they must have been really busy, because they sound like they sort of gave him a bit of a taste for junk food. But now he's a huge foodie. We talked a lot about his kitchen garden.
He has one, a kitchen garden where? In France or in the United States?
So he has a house just near in the Luberon. And he's got a huge garden there, and he explained in detail how to grow
San Marzano tomatoes.
Yeah,
and Crimean tomatoes.
And is it just him that's doing the cooking? I mean, I'd love to see John Malkovich in a pinny knocking up, you know, a sort of a quick omelette at lunchtime, just as I'm getting a picture here of a man who's very much at ease in the south of France and very much in his kitchen garden. It is not what one would tend to expect from John Malkovich.
No, he speaks perfect French, and he sounds like, I mean, he doesn't obviously need to grow his own food. It's not hardly subsistence operation down there, but he's definitely very dedicated to his kitchen garden, and he's growing just for the love of it. And he cooks even on set. He sets up a kitchen and cooks for people, cooks carrot cake for his staff.
So he's feeding this crew as well?
Yes, which was really a surprise. And his wife is Italian, so she cooks. And his daughter is apparently a fantastic chef. So
you said that in the article it says that his mother doesn't cook. Where's he got the love of food from? Or does he explain it?
He couldn't really. His taste in food is very simple. It's a bit like, it reflects his character. He likes things pared down, boiled down, and nothing too pretentious. So I think he's come to this point where he likes to grow his own food and cook his own food. And you can see that possibly if you were as famous as him, and, you know, you might just think, actually, I'd rather do it myself.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the fact that he's gone very pared down. If we look at, it's page 180 on issue 48 of this month's Monocle. There he is, all terribly relaxed and leaning back in his crisp white shirt, all very, very post-lunchtime, post-prandial, should we say. But you said he's pared all this down. An eyebrow was raised when I read what his final meal would be, because one would assume that a man of such a film icon would choose a really rather elaborate meal. He's gone for what, brochette de volaille, which in idiot's terms is what, chicken kebabs. What was your reaction to that, and why did he want that?
He did. He ordered it, and there were other more elaborate things on the menu.
But so it's fair to say it looks nice on the picture.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful food, and it was a fabulous restaurant. A really wonderful terrace overlooking the whole village in Provence. So it was perfect.
One final very quick question. It's about you actually. It's you had 3 hours in a perfect setting with John Malkovich being like the man from Dangerous Liaisons. Are we fair to admit that this man is not without his charms?
I was dazzled, I have to say, and slightly exhausted. He was quite sort of demanding company, has to be said, but he was great.
What do you mean demanding?
He's just very intense. He likes to talk about, you know, really quite serious things, and I, you know, it kind of takes it out of you a bit. But yeah, he does have a sort of penchant for playing serial killers in films. I think he's playing a serial killer in an opera at the moment.
Right, what a lovely, in between morsels of feeding carrot cake and whipping up a chicken kebab from his kitchen garden. What an image. Sophie, thank you very much indeed for coming on. It's been an absolute delight to hear about what it's like to have lunch with John Malkovich. It's a rare occurrence, and he's a very privileged girl. Santiago, that's whet up an appetite, but not for food, I'm afraid. We haven't got in the studio. You're going to have to soothe us with a song instead.
Great. Let's hear the lovely voice of Mexican artist Natalia Lafourcade with a sweet and mellow song titled Amarte Duele. That was Amarte Duele, or Loving You Hurts, by Natalia Lafourcade. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Keep abreast of everything from breaking news to fresh business opportunities with Monocle 24's lineup of live weekday current affairs programmes. The Globalist kicks off our day at 6 a.m. UK time with 2 hours of news, media reviews, weather and reports from our correspondents around the world. At midday UK time, The Briefing helps the North American East Coast get into gear with a brisk review of news and analysis. And at 18:30 UK time, Midori House gets a first read on stories hitting Asia's front pages and does a roundup with Monocle's editors. Finally, the Monocle Daily signs on for 2 hours at 2200 with a mix of our editors and special guest anchors to start the day in Asia. Keep an eye and an ear on the world right here on Monocle 24.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle Cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run around the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and Santiago Tarditi. In less than 10 minutes, we'll be experiencing our first taste of the menu. That's Monocle 24's brand new food and drink show with Tyler Brulé. But first, with membership fees in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, clubhouses designed by star architects and troops of attentive young female caddies, golf is the ultimate statement of wealth in South Korea. Business is booming. And Monocle's correspondent Danielle Dimitri has talked about her journey around South Korea's most coveted golf courses.
I think the thing that fascinates me most is how exclusive it is. It's a world that is only accessible to a really small number of people. The industry is booming there. If you're a member of a club, it means more than you just play golf. It means that you have money and power, influence, and I think that's what's most unique about the Korean golf scene. Companies are investing vast sums of money to build these extremely luxurious golf clubs. They don't even really look like sports facilities at all when you first go and visit one. They look more like very, very high-end hotels or private members' clubs. South Korean golfers clearly take golf fashion very, very seriously. You can see instantly when you go onto any golf course, any of the high-end clubs. Everyone's dressed top to toe, very bright colours, very sort of expensive clothing. I think it's a really important wing within the industry. This queen sculpture is at the entrance of the Hazley Nine Bridges Club, which is again just outside Seoul, and it's a very high-end, very, very exclusive golf club. Architecturally, they commissioned the Japanese architect Shigeru Ban and the Korean architect Yoon Kyung-sik to create the interiors. And the wood was made in Switzerland, and 60 Swiss architects were flown over specifically to install this structure. Golf courses are extremely high maintenance, but I remember speaking to one golf course designer out there, and he said that he personally thought that Korean golfers were the hardest people to please. They're the fussiest players, so they'd be the people to demand to know why a tree had died or why the grass wasn't green in a little patch. Combined with that is the fact that the Korean landscape is very harsh, the climate is very harsh, so you have very, very cold Siberian winters, very, very hot summers. It's really hard work keeping these golf courses looking cartoon perfect green. At the Jack Nicklaus Golf Club Korea, they have a whole team of people who are up at four every morning mowing the fairway. And the guy who manages the whole course, he compared his job to that of a farmer. He said he worries when it rains, he worries when it doesn't rain. Another interesting feature about that particular course is I was sitting in a buggy actually with one of the managers, and we were driving through the fairway, and he pointed out a rock feature, and he said to me, "Do you think that's real?" And I didn't really know what to say to that because it looked quite real, and obviously he was asking because it wasn't. And it turned out that it was actually created using Hollywood technology, the same kind of technology they'd use on film sets, so it wasn't real rocks at all. And he confided in the fact that actually when they initially built the course, when they threw golf balls against the rocks, it didn't make any noise at all, so they had to actually change the whole rock feature so it actually sounded realistic when golf balls hit the rock. So that just gives you some indication as to the extent that these golf clubs go to make these places beautiful and perfect.
Well, staying with us now is Santiago, our edit editor. This was an amazing piece. If you go to the magazine, you can see these quite spectacular outfits that these South Koreans are wearing. I mean, it is absolutely huge business out there, isn't it?
Amazing. There are 3.2 million golf players in South Korea, and 600 golf courses are expected to be open by 2015.
South Korea is so addicted to golf, let's say, among the upper echelons of society. I think it was, if I remember rightly, it was in 2006 that there was the so-called golf scandal that involved the Prime Minister of South Korea, who was caught playing a sneaky round one afternoon when, in fact, the rest of South Korea had just embarked upon quite a terrible strike involving all the rail networks. And it was considered to be such bad taste that, in actual fact, he had to resign.
Well, it says golf is distressing, so I kind of understand him.
Now, speaking of bad taste, well, that would be very rude of us to say. The outfits are really quite spectacular, aren't they?
Quirky, yeah. Nothing matches with anything, really.
Well, that's about it. Thank you very much indeed, Santiago, for your first trip on into Midori House. It's been a pleasure to have you here. Coming up after this, we have the very first edition of The Menu with Tyler Brulé. That's Monocle 24's very own food and drink show. There'll be a taste test on goat's milk ice cream, and there'll be also a chat with Allegra McAvidi. Later on, Tyler will be back again in the studio with the Monocle Daily. Midori House, though, will be back on Monday with the design editor Robert Bound. In the meantime, you're listening to Monocle 24.
The Rolex Yachtmaster is a universally recognised symbol of Rolex's understanding of the yachting world. The title sponsor of more than 20 world-class events, Rolex has also been a patron of the International Sailing Federation since 2001. With such intimate links to the sport, Rolex well understands the needs of these demanding and precise competitors. In 2007, the Yachtmaster 2 Regatta Chronograph won instant celebrity status with its programmable countdown equipped with a mechanical memory, the first of its kind, which can be set according to the starting sequences of each regatta. Those who have seen the sky turn black above them just before the starting horn know that they can rely on the Rolex Yachtmaster 2, the ultimate yachtman's reference watch and a unique object designed for a command performance, leaving nothing to chance. Except, perhaps, the direction of the wind. Rolex. Live for greatness.
It's 1,500 hours in Buenos Aires, 1,900 hours in London, 2,100 hours in Helsinki, to also 2,100 hours in Nairobi, and 0,500 hours in Melbourne. This is Monocle 24, live from Midori House in London. Coming up, The Menu, but first the news with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. The liberation of Libya will be declared on Saturday in the city of Benghazi, often referred to as the cradle of the revolution that overthrew Muammar Gaddafi, and not in the capital, Tripoli. Some analysts say that long-standing regional rivalries in a country only put together under Italian colonial rule in the 1930s are part of a complex of tribal, ethnic and other divisions that could hamper a return to stability. Muammar Gaddafi's body lay in an old meat store today as arguments over a burial and his killing after being captured dogged efforts by Libya's new leaders to make a formal start on a new era of democracy. Syrian forces have shot dead at least 13 anti-government protesters whose numbers were swelled by the killing of Colonel Gaddafi, according to residents and activists. Most of the killings were in the central city of Homs and in Hama to the north, the scene of some of the largest military operations in a crackdown on the seven-month uprising. President Obama said on Friday the United States will fulfill its pledge to pull troops out of Iraq by the end of the year. Mr. Obama said, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over. The African force protecting Somalia's government acknowledged today at least 10 of its troops had been killed in battle in Mogadishu and said the true toll could still climb after rebels showed dozens of bodies. East African officials held an emergency meeting to discuss the deteriorating situation in Somalia 5 days after troops from Kenya poured across the border in pursuit of kidnappers it says are linked to Somalia's Al-Shabaab rebels. Thailand battled to protect the capital Bangkok from being swamped by water today, with canals full to the brim after devastating floods across the region that sources in neighbouring Myanmar said had killed at least 100 people there. A Russian Soyuz rocket successfully blasted off from French Guiana today, bearing the first two satellites in Europe's Galileo Global Positioning System, a much-heralded mission that will redraw commercial competition in space. The launch from Europe's space base in South America was the first time that Soyuz, which first flew in 1966 and traces its roots back to the earliest Cold War intercontinental ballistic missiles, has taken off from outside its old Soviet Union bases. A Dutch court sentenced 5 ethnic Tamil men on Friday to up to 6 years in jail for helping finance Tamil tiger guerrillas with millions of euros in their ultimately failed campaign for an independent homeland in Sri Lanka. And London's cathedral, St Paul's, will close, a senior cleric said today, because of hazards posed by an Occupy Wall Street-inspired protest encamped in front of the cathedral. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.